But you must understand, unbeliever, that selecting a tale is usually a matter for deliberation. The old giantish is a wealth of stories, and some take days in the telling. Once, as a child, I heard 3 times in succession the tale of Bagoon the Unbearable and Thelma Two-Fist, who tamed him. Now that was a story worth the laughter. But 9 days were gone before I knew it. However, you do not speak giantish, and translation is a long task, even for giants. So the problem of selection is simplified. But the lore of our life in Seareach since our ships found the land contains many times many stories. Tales of the reigns of Damalon Giant Friend and Lorik Vile Silencer and Kevin, who is now called Land Waster. Tales of the building, the carving out of the mountain, of Revelstone, revered rock, a handmark of allegiance and fealty in the eternal stone of time, as Kevin once sang it, the mightiest making that the giants have done in the land, a temple for our people to look upon and remember what can be achieved. Tales of the voyage which saved us from the desecration, and of the many healings of the new lords. But again, selection is made easy because you are a stranger. I will tell you the first story of the Seareach Giants, the Song of the Unhomed.
Covenant looked about him at the shining blue tranquility of the Soul's Ease, and settled himself to hear Foam Follower's story. But the narration did not begin right away. Instead of starting his tale, the giant went back to his antique plain song, spinning the melody meditatively so that it unrolled like the sea path of the river. For a long time he sang, and under the spell of his voice, Covenant began to drowse. He had too much exhaustion dripping through his bones to keep his attention ready. While he waited, he rested against the prow like a tired swimmer. But then a modulation sharpened the giant's chant. The melody took on keener edges and turned itself to the angle of a lament. Soon Foam Follower was singing words that Covenant could understand.
We are the unhomed, lost voyagers of the world. In the land beyond the sunbirth sea, we lived and had our homes and grew, and set our sails to the wind, unheeding of the peril of the lost. We are the unhomed. From home and hearth, stone sacred dwellings crafted by our reverent hands, we set our sails to the wind of the stars and carried life to lands across the earth, careless of the peril of our loss. We are the unhomed, lost voyagers of the world. From desert shore to high cliff crag, home of men and sylvan sea edge fairylands, from dream to dream we set our sails and smiled at the rainbow of our loss. Now we are unhomed, bereft of root and kith and kin. From other mysteries of delight, we set our sails to resail our track. But the winds of life blew not the way we chose, and the land beyond the sea was lost. Ah, stone and sea. Do you know the old lore legend of the wounded rainbow, Thomas Covenant? It is said that in the dimmest past of the earth, there were no stars in our sky. The heavens were a blankness which separated us from the eternal universe of the Creator. There he lived with his people and his myriad bright children, and they moved to the music of play and joy. Now, as the ages spired from forever to forever, the Creator was moved to make a new thing for the happy hearts of his children. He descended to the great
forges and cauldrons of his power, and brewed and hammered and cast rare theurgies. And when he was done, he turned to the heavens and threw his mystic creation to the sky. And behold, a rainbow spread its arms across the universe. For a moment, the creator was glad, but then he looked closely at the rainbow. And there, high in the shimmering span, he saw a wound, a breach in the beauty he had made. He did not know that his enemy, the demon spirit of murk and mire that crawled through the bowels of even his universe, had seen him at work and had cast spite into the mortar of his creating. So now, as the rainbow stood across the heavens, it was marred. In vexation, the creator returned to his works to find a cure for his creation. But while he labored, his children, his myriad bright children, found the rainbow and were filled with rejoicing at its beauty. Together they climbed into the heavens and scampered happily up the bough, dancing gay dances across its colors. High on the span, they discovered the wound, but they did not understand it. Chorusing joy, they danced through the wound and found themselves in our sky. This new, unlighted world only gladdened them the more, and they spun through the sky until it sparkled with the glee of play. When they tired of this sport, they sought to return to their universe of light. But their door was shut, for the Creator had discovered his enemy's handiwork, the cause of the wound, and in his anger his mind had been clouded. Thoughtless, he had torn the rainbow from the heavens. Not until his anger was done did he realize that he had trapped his children in our sky. And there they remain, stars to guide the sojourners of our nights, until the Creator can rid his universe of his enemy and find a way to bring his children home. So it was with us, the unhomed. In our long-lost rocky land, we lived and flourished among our own kind, and when we learned to travel the seas, we only prospered the more. But in the eagerness of our glee and our health and our wandering, we betrayed ourselves into folly. We built 20 fine ships, each large enough to be a castle for you humans, and we made a vow among ourselves to set sail and discover the whole earth. Ah, the whole earth. In 20 ships, 2,000 giants said high farewells to their kindred, promising to bring back in stories every face of the multitudinous world. And they launched themselves into their dream. Then from sea to sea, through tempest and calm, drought and famine and plenty, between reef and landfall, the giants sailed, glorying in the bite of the salt air and the stretch of sailors' thews and the perpetual contest with the ocean, permanence in motion, and in the exaltation of binding together new peoples in the web of their wandering. 3 ships they lost in half a generation. 100 giants chose to remain and live out their lot with the sylvan fairy Elohim. 200 died in the war service of the Brother, who were nearly destroyed by the sand gorgons of the great desert. 2 ships were reefed and wrecked. And when the first children born on the voyage were old enough to be sailors themselves, the 15 vessels held counsel and turned their thoughts toward home, for they had learned the folly of their vow and were worn from wrestling with the seas. So they set their sails by the stars and sought for home. But they were prevented. Familiar paths led them to unknown oceans and unencountered perils. Tempests drove them beyond their reckoning until their hands were stripped to the bone by the flailing ropes, and the waves rose up against them as if in hatred. 5 more ships were lost, though the wreckage of one was found, and the sailors of another were rescued from the island on which they had been cast. Through ice that held them in its clutch for many seasons, killing scores of them, through calms that made them close comrades of starvation, they endured, struggling for their lives and home. But disasters erased every vestige of knowledge from their bearings until they knew not where they were or where to go. When they reached the land, they cast their anchors. Less than 1,000 giants stepped down to the rocky shore of Sea Reach. In disconsolation, they gave up their hope of home. But the friendship of High Lord Damalon Harthu's son renewed them. He saw omens of promise in his mighty lore, and at his word the giants lifted up their hearts. They made Sea Reach their place and swore fealty to the lords, and sent 3 vessels out in quest of home. Since that time, for more than 3 times 1,000 years, there have always been 3 giant ships at sea, seeking our land turn by turn, 3 new standing out when the old return, their hands empty of success. Still we are unhomed, lost in the labyrinth of a foolish dream. Stone and sea, we are a long-lived people compared to your humans. I was born on shipboard during the short voyage which saved us from the desecration, and my great-grandparents were among the first wanderers. And we have so few children. Rarely does any woman bear more than 1 child. So now there are only 500 of us, and our vitality narrows with each generation. We cannot forget. But in the old lore legend, the children of the Creator had hope. He put rainbows in our sky after cleansing rains as a promise to the stars that somehow, someday, he would find a way to bring them home. If we are to survive, we must find the home that we have lost, the heartland beyond the sunbirth sea. During Foam Follower's tale, the sun had declined into late afternoon. And as he finished, sunset began on the horizon. Then the Soul's Ease ran out of the west with fiery orange-gold glory, reflected flame for flame in its burnished countenance. In the fathomless heavens, the fire radiated both loss and prophecy, coming night and promised day, darkness which would pass. For when the true end of day and light came, there would be no blazonry to make it admirable, no spectacle or fine fire or joy, nothing for the heart to behold but decay and gray ashes. In splendor, Foam Follower lifted up his voice again and sang with a plummeting ache, "We set our sails to resail our track, but the winds of life blew not the way we chose, and the land beyond the sea was lost." Covenant pushed himself around to look at the giant. Foam Follower's head was held high, with wet streaks of gleaming gold-orange fire drawn delicately down his cheeks. As Covenant watched, the reflected light took on a reddish shade and began to fade. Softly, the giant said, "Laugh, Thomas Covenant. Laugh for me. Joy is in the ears that hear." Covenant heard the subdued, undemanding throb and supplication in Foam Follower's voice, and his own choked pain groaned in answer. But he could not laugh. He had no laughter of any kind in him. With a spasm of disgust for the limitations that crippled him, he made a rough effort in another direction. "I'm hungry." For an instant, Foam Follower's shadowed eyes flared as if he had been stung. but then he put back his head and laughed for himself. His humor seemed to spring straight from his heart, and soon it had banished all tension and tears from his visage. When he had relaxed into quiet chuckling, he said, "Thomas Covenant, I do not like to be hasty, but I believe you are my friend. You have toppled my pride, and that would be fair service even had I not laughed at you earlier. Hungry? Of course you are hungry. Bravely said. I should have offered you food earlier. You have the transparent look of a man who has eaten only Aliantha for days. Some old seers say that privation refines the soul, but I say it is soon enough to refine the soul when the body has no other choice. Happily, I am well supplied with food." He pushed a prodigious leather sack toward Covenant with his foot and motioned for him to open it. When Covenant loosened its drawstrings, he found salt beef, cheese, old bread, and more than a dozen tangerines as big as his two fists, as well as a leather jug which he could hardly lift. To postpone this difficulty, he tackled the staples first, washing the salt out of his throat with sections of a tangerine. Then he turned his attention to the jug. "That is diamond rot," said Foam Follower. "It is a vital brew. Perhaps I should... No. The more I look at you, my friend, the more weariness I see. Just drink from the jug. It will aid your rest." Tilting the jug, Covenant sipped the diamond rot. It tasted like light whiskey, and he could smell its potency. But it was so smooth that it did not bite or burn. He took several relishing swallows, and at once felt deeply refreshed. Carefully he closed the jug, replaced the food in the sack, then with an effort pushed the sack back into Foam Follower's reach. The diamond draught glowed in his belly, and he felt that in a little while he would be ready for another story. But as he lay down under the thwarts in the bow, the twilight turned into crystal darkness in the sky, and the stars came out lornly like scattered children. Before he knew that he was drowsing, he was asleep. It was an uneasy slumber. He staggered numbly through plague-ridden visions full of dying moons and slaughter and helpless, ravaged flesh, and found himself lying in the street near the front bumper of the police car. A circle of townspeople had gathered around him. They had eyes of flint, and their mouths were stretched in one uniform rictus of denunciation. Without exception, they were pointing at his hands. When he lifted his hands to look at them, he saw that they were rife with purple, leprous bruises. Then two white-clad, brawny men came up to him and manhandled him into a stretcher. He could see the ambulance nearby. But the men did not carry him to it immediately. They stood still, holding him at waist level like a display to the crowd. A policeman stepped into the circle. His eyes were the color of contempt. He bent over Covenant and said sternly, "You got in my way. That was wrong. You ought to be ashamed." His breath covered Covenant with the smell of attar. Behind the policeman, someone raised his voice. It was as full of unction as that of Jones' lawyer. It said, "That was wrong." In perfect unison, all the townspeople vomited gouts of blood onto the pavement. "I don't believe this," Covenant thought. At once the unctuous voice purred, "He doesn't believe us." A silent howl of reality, a rabid assertion of fact, sprang up from the crowd. It battered Covenant until he cowered under it, abject and answerless. Then the townspeople chorused, "You are dead. Without the community, you can't live. Life is in the community, and you have no community. You can't live if no one cares." The unison of their voices made a sound like crumbling, crushing. When they stopped, Covenant felt that the air in his lungs had been turned to rubble. With a sigh of satisfaction, the unctuous voice said, "Take him to the hospital. Heal him. There is only one good answer to death. Heal him and throw him out." The two men swung him into the ambulance. Before the door slammed shut, he saw the townspeople shaking hands with each other, beaming their congratulations. After that, the ambulance started to move. He raised his hands and saw that the purple spots were spreading up his forearms. He stared at himself in horror, moaning, "Hellfire, hellfire, hellfire." But then a bubbling tenor voice said kindly, "Do not fear. It is a dream." The reassurance spread over him like a blanket, but he could not feel it with his hands, and the ambulance kept on moving. Kneading the blanket, he clenched at the empty air until his knuckles were white with loneliness. When he felt that he could not ache any more, the ambulance rolled over, and he fell out of the stretcher into blankness. Chapter 12. Revelstone. The pressure against his left cheek began slowly to wear his skin raw, and the pain nagged him up off the bottom of his slumber. Turbulence rushed under his head as if he were pillowed on shoals. He labored his way out of sleep. Then his cheek was jolted twice in rapid succession, and his resting place heaved. Pushing himself up, he smacked his head on a thwart of the boat. Pain throbbed in his skull. He gripped the thwart, swung himself away from the rib which had been rubbing his cheek, and sat up to look over the gunwales. He found that the situation of the boat had changed radically. No shade or line or resonance of Andalanian richness remained in the surrounding terrain. On the northeast, the river was edged by a high, bluff rock wall, and to the west spread a gray and barren plain, a crippled wilderness like a vast battleground where more than men had been slain, where the fire that scorched and the blood that drenched had blighted the ground's ability to revitalize itself, bloom again. An uneven, despoiled lowland marked only by the scrub trees clinging to life along the river which poured into the Solzies a few hundred yards ahead of the boat. The eastering wind carried an old burnt odor, and behind it lay the fetid memory of a crime. Already the river joining ahead troubled the Solzies, knotted its current, stained its clarity with flinty mud, and Covenant had to grip the gunwales to keep his balance as the pitching of the boat increased. Foam Follower held the boat in the center of the river, away from the turmoil against the northeast rock wall. Covenant glanced back at the giant. He was standing in the stern, feet widely braced, tiller clamped under his right arm. At Covenant's glance, he called over the mounting clash of the rivers, "Trothgard lies ahead. Here we turn north. The White River! The Grey comes from the west!" His voice had a strident edge to it, as if he had been singing as strongly as he could all night. But after a moment he sang out a fragment of a different song. "For we will not rest, not turn aside, lose faith or fail, until the Grey flows blue, and Rill and Marl are as new and clean as ancient Lurlin." The heaving of the river mounted steadily. Covenant stood in the bottom of the boat, bracing himself against one of the thwarts, gripping the gunwale, and watched the forced commingling of the clean and tainted waters. Then Foam Follower shouted, 100 leagues to the western mountains, Guards Gap and the high spring of the Lurlin, and 150 southwest to the last hills and Garotting Deep. We are 70 from Lord's Keep." Abruptly, the river's moiling growl sprang louder, smothered the giant's voice. An unexpected lash of the current caught the boat and tore its prow to the right, bringing it broadside to the stream. Spray slapped Covenant as the boat heeled over. Instinctively, he threw his weight onto the left gunwale. The next instant he heard a snatch of Foam Follower's plainsong and felt power thrumming deeply along the keel. Slowly the boat righted itself, swung into the current again. But the near disaster had carried them dangerously close to the northeast wall. The boat trembled with energy as Foam Follower worked it gradually back into the steadier water flowing below the main force of the Gray's current. Then the sensation of power faded from the keel.
"Your pardon," the giant shouted. "I am losing my seamanship."
His voice was raw with strain. Covenant's knuckles were white from clenching the gunwales. As he bounced with the pitch of the boat, he remembered, there is only one good answer to death. One good answer, he thought. This isn't it. Perhaps it would be better if the boat capsized, better if he drowned, better if he did not carry Lord Fowl's message half-handed and be ringed to Revelstone. He was not a hero. He could not satisfy such expectations.
"Now the crossing," Foam Follower called. "We must pass the Gray to go on north. There is no great danger, except that I am weary, and the rivers are high."
This time Covenant turned and looked closely at the giant. He saw now that Saltheart Foam Follower was suffering. His cheeks were sunken, hollowed as if something had gouged the geniality out of his face, and his cavernous eyes burned with taut, febrile volition. Weary, Covenant thought. More like exhausted. He lurched awkwardly from thwart to thwart until he reached the giant. His eyes were no higher than Foam Follower's waist. He tipped his head back to shout, "I'll steer. You rest." A smile flickered on the giant's lips.
"I thank you. But no, you are not ready. I am strong enough. But please, lift the diamond draught to me."
Covenant opened the food sack and put his hands on the leather jug. Its weight and suppleness made it unwieldy for him, and the tossing of the boat unbalanced him. He simply could not lift the jug. But after a moment, he got his arms under it. With a groan of exertion, he heaved it upward. Foam Follower caught the neck of the jug neatly in his left hand.
"Thank you, my friend," he said with a ragged grin.
Raising the jug to his mouth, he disregarded the perils of the current for a moment to drink deeply. Then he put down the jug and swung the boat toward the mouth of the Gray River. Another surge of power throbbed through the craft. As it hit the main force of the Gray, Foam Follower turned downstream and angled across the flow. Energy quivered in the floorboards. In a smooth maneuver, Foam Follower reached the north side of the current, pivoted upstream with the backwash along the wall, and let it sling him into the untroubled white. Once he had rounded the northward curve, the roar of the joining began to drop swiftly behind the boat. A moment later, the throb of power faded again. Sighing heavily, Foam Follower wiped the sweat from his face. His shoulders sagged and his head bowed. With labored slowness, he lowered the tiller and at last dropped into the stern of the boat.
"Ah, my friend," he groaned. "Even giants are not made to do such things."
Covenant moved to the center of the boat and took a seat in the bottom, leaning against one of the sides. From that position, he could not see over the gunwales, but he was not at present curious about the terrain. He had other concerns. One of them was Foam Follower's condition. He did not know how the giant had become so exhausted. He tried to approach the question indirectly by saying, "That was neatly done. How did you do it? You didn't tell me what powers this thing." And he frowned at the tactless sound of his voice.
"Ask for some other story," Foam Follower sighed wearily. "That one is nearly as long as the history of the land. I have no heart to teach you the meaning of life here."
"You don't know any short stories," responded Covenant. At this, the giant managed a wan smile.
"Ah, that is true enough. Well, I will make it brief for you. But then you must promise to tell a story for me. Something rare, that I will never guess for myself. I will need that, my friend."
Covenant agreed with a nod, and Foam Follower said,
"Well,
Eat, and I will talk. Vaguely surprised at how hungry he was, Covenant tackled the contents of Foam Follower's sack. He munched meat and cheese rapidly, satisfied his thirst with tangerines. And while he ate, the giant began in a voice flat with fatigue. The time of Damalon, giant friend, came to an end in the land before my people had finished the making of Kurkri, their home in Sea Reach. They carved Lord's Keep, as men call it, out of the mountain's heart before they labored on their own Lord-given land, and Lorik was High Lord when Kurkri was done. Then my forebearers turned their attention outward, to the Sunbirth Sea and to the friendship of the land. Now, both Lilianril and Rodamarl desired to study the lore of the giants, and the time of High Lord Lorik Vile Silencer was one of great growth for the Lilianril. To help in this growth, it was necessary for the giants to make many sojourns to Lord's Keep. He broke into a quiet chant, singing for a while as if in invocation of the old grandeur of giantish reverence, to mighty Revelstone. This was well, for it kept Revelstone bright in their eyes. But the giants are not great lovers of walking, no more so then than now. So my forebearers bethought them of the rivers which flow from the western mountains to the sea, and decided to build boats. Well, boats cannot come here from the sea, as you may know. Land's drop on which stands Gravin Threndor blocks the way, and no one, giant or otherwise, would willingly sail the defile's course from Life Swallower, the great swamp. So the giants built docks on the Soul's Ease, upriver from Gravin Threndor and the narrows now called Treacher's Gorge. There they kept such boats as this. There, and at Lord's Keep at the foot of Furl Falls, so that at least 200 leagues of the journey might be on the water which we love. In this journeying, Lorik and the Lilianril desired to be of aid to the giants. Out of their power they crafted Gildenlode, a strong wood which they named Lor Lyril, and from this wood they made rudders and keels for our riverboats. And it was the promise of the old lords that when their omens of hope for us came to pass, then Gildenlode would help us. Ah, enough, Foam Follower sighed abruptly. In short, it is I who impel this craft. He lifted his hand from the tiller, and immediately the boat began to lose headway. Or rather, it is I who call out the power of the Gildenlode. There is life and power in the earth, in stone and wood and water and earth. But life in them is somewhat hidden, somewhat slumberous. Both knowledge and strength are needed. Yes. And potent, vital songs to awaken them. He grasped the tiller again, and the boat moved forward once more. So I am weary, he breathed. I have not rested since the night before we met. His tone reminded Covenant of Trell's fatigue after the Gravelingers had healed the broken pot. For 2 days and 2 nights I have not allowed the Gildenlode to stop or slow, though my bones are weak with the expense. To the surprise in Covenant's face, he added, Yes, my friend, you slept for 2 nights and a day. From the west of Andalane across the center plains to the marge of Trothgard, more than 100 leagues. After a pause, he concluded, Diamond Rot does such things to humans, but you had need of rest. For a moment, Covenant sat silent, staring at the floorboards as if he were looking for a place to hit them. His mouth twisted sourly when he raised his head and said, So now I'm rested. Can I help? Foam Follower did not reply immediately. Behind the buttress of his forehead, he seemed to weigh his various uncertainties before he muttered, "Stone and sea. Of course you can. And yet the very fact of asking shows that you cannot. Some unwillingness or ignorance prevents." Covenant understood. He could hear dark wings, see slaughtered wraiths. "Wild magic," he groaned. "Heroism. This is insufferable." With a jerk of his head, he knocked transitions aside and asked roughly, "Do you want my ring?" "Want?" Foam Follower croaked, looking as if he felt he should laugh, but did not have the heart for it. "Want?" His voice quavered painfully, as if he were confessing to some kind of aberration. "Do not use such a word, my friend. Wanting is natural, and may succeed or fail without wrong. Say covet, rather. To covet is to desire something which should not be given. Yes, I covet your unearthed wild magic, peace-ending white gold. There is wild magic graven in every rock, contained for white gold to unleash or control. I admit the desire, but do not tempt me. Power has a way of revenging itself upon its usurpers. I would not accept this ring if you offered it to me." "But you do know how to use it?" Covenant inquired dully, half dazed by his inchoate fear of the answer. This time Foam Follower did laugh. His humor was emaciated, a mere wisp of its former self, but it was clean and gay. "Ah, bravely said, my friend. So covetousness collapses of its own folly. No, I do not know. If the wild magic may not be called up by the simple decision of use, then I do not understand it at all. Giants do not have such lore. We have always acted for ourselves, though we gladly use such tools as Gildenlode. Well, I am rewarded for unworthy thoughts. Your pardon, Thomas Covenant." Covenant nodded mutely, as if he had been given an unexpected reprieve. He did not want to know how wild magic worked. He did not want to believe in it in any way. Simply carrying it around was dangerous. He covered it with his right hand and gazed dumbly, helplessly at the giant. After a moment, Foam Follower's fatigue quenched his humor. His eyes dimmed and his respiration sighed wearily between his slack lips. He sagged on the tiller as if laughing had cost him vital energy. "Oh, my friend," he breathed, "my courage is nearly spent. I need your story." "Story," Covenant thought. "I don't have any stories. I burned them." He had burned them, both his new novel and his bestseller. They had been so complacent, so abjectly blind to the perils of leprosy, which lurked secretive and unpredictable behind every physical or moral existence, and so unaware of their own sightlessness. They were carrion, like himself, fit only for flames. What story could he tell now? But he had to keep moving, act, survive. Surely he had known that before he had become the victim of dreams. Had he not learned it at the leprosarium, in putrefaction and vomit? Yes, yes, survive. And yet this dream expected power of him, expected him to put an end to slaughter. Images flashed through him like splinters of vertigo, mirror shards. Joan, police car, drools, Laval eyes. He reeled as if he were falling. To conceal his sudden distress, he moved away from Foam Follower, went to sit in the prow facing north. "A story," he said thickly. In fact, he did know one story. One story in all its grim and motley disguises. He sorted quickly, vividly, until he found one which suited the other things he needed to articulate. I'll tell you a story. A true story. He gripped the gunwales, fought down his dizziness. It's a story about culture shock. Do you know what culture shock is? Foam follower did not reply. Never mind. I'll tell you about it. Culture shock is what happens when you take a man out of his own world and put him down in a place where the assumptions, the standards of being a person, are so different that he can't possibly understand them. He isn't built that way. If he's facile, he can pretend to be someone else until he gets back to his own world. Or he can just collapse and let himself be rebuilt. However, there's no other way. I'll give you an example. While I was at the leprosarium, the doctors talked about a man, a leper like me. Outcast. He was a classic case. He came from another country, where leprosy is a lot more common. He must have picked up the bacillus there as a child, and years later, when he had a wife and three kids of his own and was living in another country, he suddenly lost the nerves in his toes and started to go blind. Well, if he had stayed in his own country, he would have been... The disease is common. It would have been recognized early. As soon as it was recognized, he and his wife and his kids... And everything he owned, and his house, and his animals, and his close relatives, they would have all been declared unclean. His property and house and animals would have been burned to the ground, and he and his wife and his kids and his close relatives would have been sent away to live in the most abject poverty in a village with other people who had the same disease. He would have spent the rest of his life there. Without treatment, without hope, while hideous deformity gnawed his arms and legs and face, until he and his wife and his kids and his close relatives all died of gangrene. Do you think that's cruel? Let me tell you what did happen to the man. As soon as he recognized his disease, he went to his doctor. His doctor sent him to the leprosarium, alone, without his family, where the spread of the disease was arrested. He was treated, given medicine and training, rehabilitated. Then he was sent home to live a normal life with his wife and kids. How nice. There was only one problem. He couldn't handle it. To start with, his neighbors gave him a hard time. Oh, at first, they didn't know he was sick. They weren't familiar with leprosy, didn't recognize it. But the local newspaper printed a story on him so that everyone in town knew he was the leper. They shunned him, hated him, because they didn't know what to do about him. Then he began to have trouble keeping up his self-treatments. His home country didn't have medicine and leper's therapy. In his bones, he believed that such things were magic, that once his disease was arrested, he was cured, pardoned, given a stay of something worse than execution. But lo and behold, when he stops taking care of himself, the numbness starts to spread again. Then comes the clincher. Suddenly, he finds that behind his back, while he wasn't even looking, much less alert, he has been cut off from his family. They don't share his trouble. Far from it. They want to get rid of him, go back to living the way they were before. So they pack him off to the leprosarium again. But after getting on the plane, they didn't have planes in his home country either. He goes into the bathroom as if he had been disinherited without anyone ever telling him why, and slits his wrists. He gaped wide-eyed at his own narration, He would have been willing, eager, to weep for the man if he had been able to do so without sacrificing his own defenses. But he could not weep. Instead, he swallowed thickly and let his momentum carry him on again. And I'll tell you something else about culture shock. Every world has its own ways of committing suicide, and it is a lot easier to kill yourself using methods that you're not accustomed to. I could never slit my wrists. I've read too much about it, talked about it too much. It's too vivid. I would throw up. But I could go to that man's world and sip belladonna tea without nausea, because I don't know enough about it. There's something vague about it, something obscure, something not quite fatal. So that poor man in the bathroom sat there for over an hour, just letting his lifeblood run into the sink. He didn't try to get help until all of a sudden, finally, he realized that he was going to die just as dead as if he had sipped belladonna tea. Then he tried to open the door, but he was too weak, and he didn't know how to push the button to get help. They eventually found him in this grotesque position on the floor with his fingers broken, as if he had tried to crawl under the door. He could not go on. Grief choked him into silence, and he sat still for a time while water lamented dimly past the prow. He felt sick, desperate for survival. He could not submit to these seductions. Then Foam Follower's voice reached him. Softly, the giant said, "Is this why you abandoned the telling of stories?" Covenant sprang up, whirled in instant rage. "This land of yours is trying to kill me," he spat fiercely. "You're pressuring me into suicide. White gold, Beric, wraiths. You're doing things to me that I can't handle. I'm not that kind of person. I don't live in that kind of world. All these seductions, hell and blood. I'm a leper. Don't you understand that?" For a long moment, Foam Follower met Covenant's hot gaze, and the sympathy in the giant's eyes stopped his outburst. He stood glaring with his fingers clawed while Foam Follower regarded him sadly, wearily. He could see that the giant did not understand. Leprosy was a word that seemed to have no meaning in the land. "Come on," he said with an ache. "Laugh about it. Joy is in the ears that hear." But then Foam Follower showed that he did understand something. He reached into his jerkin and drew out a leather packet, which he unfolded to produce a large sheet of supple hide. "Here," he said, "you will see much of this before you are done with the land. It is Klingor. The giants brought it to the land long ages ago, but I will spare us both the effort of telling." He tore a small square from the corner of the sheet and handed the piece to Covenant. It was sticky on both sides, but transferred easily from hand to hand and left no residue of glue behind. "Trust it. Place your ring upon that piece and hide it under your raiment. No one will know that you bear a talisman of wild magic." Covenant grasped at the idea. Tugging his ring from his finger, he placed it on the square of Klingor. It stuck firmly. He could not shake the ring loose, but he could peel the Klingor away without difficulty. Nodding sharply to himself, he placed his ring on the leather, then opened his shirt and pressed the Klingor to the center of his chest. It held there, gave him no discomfort. Rapidly, as if to seize an opportunity before it passed, he rebuttoned his shirt. To his surprise, he seemed to feel the weight of the ring on his heart, but he resolved to ignore it. Carefully, Foam Follower refolded the Klingor, replaced it within his jerkin. Then he studied Covenant again briefly. Covenant tried to smile in response, express his gratitude, but his face seemed only capable of snarls. At last he turned away, reseated himself in the prow to watch the boat's progress and absorb what Foam Follower had done for him. After musing for a time, he remembered Atiyarin's stone knife. It made possible a self-discipline that he sorely needed. He leaned over the side of the boat to wet his face, then took up the knife and painstakingly shaved his whiskers. The beard was 8 days old, but the keen, slick blade slid smoothly over his cheeks and down his neck, and he did a passable job of shaving without cutting himself. But he was out of practice, no longer accustomed to the risk. The prospect of blood made his heart tremble. Then he began to see how urgently he needed to return to his real world, needed to recover himself before he altogether lost his ability to survive as a leper. Later that day came rain, a light drizzle which spattered the surface of the river, whirling the sky mirror into myriad pieces. The drops brushed his face like spray, seeped slowly into his clothes until he was as soaked and uncomfortable as if he had been drenched. But he endured it in a gray, dull reverie, thinking about what he gained and lost by hiding his ring. At last, the day ended. Darkness dripped into the air as if the rain were simply becoming blacker, and in the twilight, Covenant and Foam Follower ate their supper glumly. The giant was almost too weak to feed himself, but with Covenant's help he managed a decent meal, drank a great quantity of diamond draught. Then they returned their respective silences. Covenant was glad for the dusk. It spared him the sight of Foam Follower's exhaustion. Unwilling to lie down on the damp floorboards, he huddled cold and wet against the side of the boat and tried to relax, sleep. After a time, Foam Follower began to chant faintly, "Stone and sea are deep in life, two unalterable symbols of the world, permanence at rest and permanence in motion, participants in the power that remains." He seemed to gather strength from the song, and with it he impelled the boat steadily against the current, drove northward as if there were no fatigue that could make him falter. Finally, the rain stopped. The cloud cover slowly broke open. But Covenant and Foam Follower found no relief in the clear sky. Over the horizon, the red moon stood like a blot, an imputation of evil on the outraged background of the stars. It turned the surrounding terrain into a dank bloodscape, full of crimson and evanescent forms like uncomprehended murders. And from the light came a putrid emanation, as if the land were illumined by a bane. Then Foam Follower's plain songs sounded dishearteningly frail, futile, and the stars themselves seemed to shrink away from the moon's course. But dawn brought a sunlight-washed day, unriven by any taint or memory of taint. When Covenant raised himself to look around, he saw mountains directly to the north. They spread away westward, where the tallest of them were still snow-crested. But the range ended abruptly at a point in line with the White River. Already the mountains seemed near at hand.
10 leagues, Foam Follower whispered hoarsely. Half a day against this current.
The giant's appearance filled Covenant with sharp dismay. Dull-eyed and slack-lipped, Foam Follower looked like a corpse of himself. His beard seemed grayer, as if he had aged several years overnight, and a trail of spittle he was helpless to control ran from the corner of his mouth. The pulse in his temples limped raggedly, but his grip on the tiller was as hard as a gnarled knot of wood, and the boat plowed stiffly up the briskening river. Covenant moved to the stern to try to be of help. He wiped the giant's lips, then held up the jug of diamond draught so that Foam Follower could drink. The fragments of a smile cracked the giant's lips, and he breathed,
"Stone and sea, it is no easy thing to be your friend. Tell your next ferryman to take you downstream. Destinations are for stronger souls than mine.
Nonsense, said Covenant gruffly. They're going to make up songs about you for this. Don't you think it's worth it?
Foam Follower tried to respond, but the effort made him cough violently, and he had to retreat into himself, concentrate the fading fire of his spirit on the clench of his fist and the progress of the boat.
That's all right, Covenant said softly. Everyone who helps me ends up exhausted, one way or another. If I were a poet, I would make up your song myself.
Cursing silently at his helplessness, he fed the giant sections of tangerine until there was no fruit left. As he looked at Foam Follower, the tall being shriven of everything except the power to endure, self-divested, for reasons Covenant could not comprehend, of every quality of humor or even dignity, as if they were mere appurtenances, he felt irrationally in debt to Foam Follower, as if he had been sold, behind his back and with blithe unregard for his consent, into the usury of his only friend.
Everyone who helps me, he muttered again.
He found the prices the people of the land were willing to pay for him appalling. Finally, he was no longer able to stand the sight. He returned to the bow, where he stared at the looming mountains with deserted eyes and grumbled, I didn't ask for this. Do I hate myself so much? He demanded. But his only answer was the rattle of Foam Follower's breathing. Half the morning passed that way, measured in butchered hunks out of the impenetrable circumstance of time by the rasp of Foam Follower's respiration. Around the boat, the terrain stiffened, as if preparing itself for a leap into the sky. The hills grew higher and more ragged, gradually leaving behind the heather and banyan trees of the plains for a stiffer scrub grass and a few scattered cedars. And ahead, the mountains stood taller beyond the hills with every curve of the river. Now Covenant could see that the east end of the range dropped steeply to a plateau like a stair into the mountains. A plateau perhaps 2,000 or 3,000 feet high that ended in a straight cliff to the foothills. From the plateau came a waterfall, and some effect of the light on the rock made the cascade gleam pale blue as it tumbled.
Furrow Falls, Covenant said to himself.
In spite of the rattle of Foam Follower's breathing, he felt a stirring in his heart, as if he were drawing near to something grand. But the drawing near lost its swiftness steadily. As the white wound between the hills, it narrowed, and as a result, the current grew increasingly stiff. The giant seemed to have passed the end of his endurance. His respiration sounded stertorous enough to strangle him at any time. He moved the boat hardly faster than a walk. Covenant did not see how they could cover the last leagues. He studied the riverbanks for a place to land the boat. He intended somehow to make the giant take the boat to shore. But while he was still looking, he heard a low rumble in the air like the running of horses. What the hell? A vision of Ervile's flared in his mind. He snatched up his staff from the bottom of the boat and clenched it, trying to control the sudden drum of his trepidation. The next moment, like a breaking wave over the crest of a hill upstream and east from the boat, came cantering a score of horses bearing riders. The riders were human, men and women. The instant they saw the boat, one of them shouted, and the group broke into a gallop, sweeping down the hill to rein in at the edge of the river. The riders looked like warriors. They wore high, soft-soled boots over black leggings, black sleeveless shirts covered by breastplates molded of a yellow metal and yellow headbands. A short sword hung from each belt, a bow and quiver of arrows from each back. Scanning them rapidly, Covenant saw the characteristic features of both Woodhelvenin and Stone Downer. Some were tall and fair, light-eyed and slim, and others square, dark, and muscular. As soon as their horses were stopped, the riders slapped their right fists in unison to their hearts, then extended their arms, palms forward in the gesture of welcome. A man distinguished by a black diagonal line across his breastplate shouted over the water, "Hail, Rock Brother! Welcome and honor and fealty to you and your people. I am Quan, Warhaft of the Third Yeoman of the Warword of Lord's Keep." He paused for a reply, and when Covenant said nothing, he went on in a more cautious tone, "Lord Morum sent us. He saw that important matters were moving on the river today. We are come as escort." Covenant looked at Foamfollower, but what he saw only convinced him that the giant was past knowing what happened around him. He slumped in the stern, deaf and blind to everything except his failing effort to drive the boat. Covenant turned back toward the yeoman and called out, "Help us! He's dying!" Quan stiffened, then sprang into action. He snapped an order, and the next instant he and two other riders plunged their horses into the river. The two others headed directly for the west bank, but Quan guided his horse to intercept the boat. The Mustang swam powerfully, as if such work were part of its training. Quan soon neared the boat. At the last moment, he stood up on his mount's back and vaulted easily over the gunwales. On command, his horse started back toward the east bank. Momentarily, Quan measured Covenant with his eyes, and Covenant saw in his thick black hair, broad shoulders, and transparent face that he was a stone downer. Then the Warhaft moved toward Foamfollower. He gripped the giant's shoulders and shook them, barking words which Covenant could not understand. At first, Foamfollower did not respond. He sat sightless, transfixed, with his hand clamped like a death grip onto the tiller. But slowly Quan's voice seemed to penetrate him. The cords of his neck trembled as he lifted his head, torturously brought his eyes into focus on Quan. Then, with a groan that seemed to spring from the very marrow of his bones, he released the tiller and fell over sideways. The craft immediately lost headway, began drifting back downriver. But by this time, the two other riders were ready on the west bank. Quan stepped past Covenant into the bow of the boat, and when he was in position, one of the two riders threw the end of a long line to him. He caught it neatly and looped it over the prow. It stuck where he put it. It was not rope, but Klingor. At once he turned toward the east bank. Another line reached him, and he attached it also to the prow. The lines pulled taut. The boat stopped drifting. Then Quan waved his arm, and the riders began moving along the banks, pulling the boat upstream. As soon as he understood what was being done, Covenant turned back to Foamfollower. The giant lay where he had fallen, and his breathing was shallow, irregular. Covenant groped momentarily for some way to help, then lifted the leather jug and poured a quantity of diamond draught over Foamfollower's head. The liquid ran into his mouth. He sputtered at it, swallowed heavily. Then he took a deep, rattling breath, and his eyes slitted open. Covenant held the jug to his lips, and after drinking from it, he stretched out flat in the bottom of the boat. At once, he fell into deep sleep. In relief, Covenant murmured over him, "Now that's a fine way to end a song." And then he went to sleep. What good is being a hero if you don't stay awake until you get congratulated? He felt suddenly tired, as if the giant's exhaustion had drained his own strength, and sighing, he sat down on one of the thwarts to watch their progress up the river, while Quan went to the stern to take the tiller. For a while, Covenant ignored Quan's scrutiny. But finally, he gathered enough energy to say, "He's Salt Heart Foamfollower. A legate from the Sea Reach Giants. He hasn't rested since he picked me up in the center of Andalane 3 days ago." He saw comprehension of Foamfollower's plight spread across Quan's face. Then he turned his attention to the passing terrain. The towing horses kept up a good pace against the White's tightening current. Their riders deftly managed the variations of the riverbanks, trading haulers and slackening one rope or the other whenever necessary. As they moved north, the soil became rockier, and the scrub grass gave way to bracken. Gilden trees spread their broad boughs and leaves more and more thickly over the foothills, and the sunlight made the gold foliage glow warmly. Ahead, the plateau now appeared nearly a league wide, and on its west the mountains stood erect as if they were upright in pride. By noon, Covenant could hear the roar of the great